Welcome to the House Einstein podcast. In this podcast, we're going to be talking about the sale of the week, what's happening in the news here in Colorado. We'll tell you something you might not know about what's happening in real estate, and then we'll give you a little tale from the trenches before we wrap up. And the House Einstein podcast, the mission here is the same as our brokerage. Our goal is to help you make a smarter real estate decision. I am your host, Osman Parvez. I'm a realtor with House Einstein and also the founder of the company. And with me is Hamish Crabb.
Hello, hello. For the purposes of this podcast, I am producer, though on a larger scale, I help keep the brokerage run smoothly. I assist from deals to marketing and everything in between.
And does an exceptional job. We are.
Thank you, Oz.
Hopefully also having fun in what we do.
These smiles don't lie.
These smiles don't. I think our smiles don't lie. You could tell a lying smile by the laugh lines and other micro expressions that people make. Yeah. But that truly is our mission. And this podcast is an adjunct to it. It's an additional way we produce content and share it with the world. But it is to be considered entertainment. So if you are a client of the firm or thinking about becoming a client of House Einstein, please contact your House Einstein agent to discuss your specific real estate situation. This podcast is not legal advice or real estate advice. We're not going to tell you what to do with your relationships. And if we do, you shouldn't do it. Don't invest on of what you hear here. Don't decide to sell your real estate on the basis of what you hear here in this podcast. So, and hopefully we'll stay on topic. So one of the things, I don't know about you, Hamish, but I do listen to quite a few podcasts, and it drives me crazy when they launch in and don't just give you that rundown of content of what to expect. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's really important that we share our intention, our content plan with you, so you know if this podcast is for you. And if you're listening to it on something like YouTube, you can also click the chapter buttons and skip ahead to the area of your particular interest.
That's right. And the time codes will be in the descriptions for everything else as well.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you can find us, if you're looking for more info about House Einstein, at houseeinstein.com. You can like and subscribe to the podcast or the YouTube or wherever you happen to be listening or watching this. That really helps us get the word out. Feel free to share our content with your friends, your family. Let's jump into it. What do you think?
Yeah, let's go.
So the market conditions for this week. We are nearing the end of February. There's less than a week to go. If you are a fan of the Suns, Stout Month is almost over. Get your last stouts in. If you need that Girl Scout stout, it's almost done. But the data that you will now see early next week for the month of February really won't be accurate until at least the 9th or the 10th of the month. The early data for the whole month is largely fictitious because agents need to add their closings that occur at the end of the month, and that typically is when most closings happen, toward the end of the month. So what we can do is give you some preliminary information about what's happening in the market right now. But keep in mind that as the month approaches, you'll see some variances. So one of the things you should be thinking about while I'm looking this up and doing it in real time is when you're writing an offer or you are thinking about accepting an offer or you're listing your home for sale, your realtor should be doing exactly what we're doing, but down to the street level. You should be looking at the most relevant competitors and the most relevant recently sold comps. And for the competitors under contract, we even call our colleagues and ask them, how did it go? How many weeks away are you from closing? Did you end up over or under the list price? How many showings were you getting? And because we have really good relationships with the brokerage community, and I do a lot to protect those relationships, most agents are pretty forthcoming. And that information is incredibly powerful to buyers and sellers because you have real-time information about what's happening in the market relevant to your specific situation, the home you're thinking about buying or selling. And anything else is not good enough, in my opinion, because you're likely to leave a lot of money on the table or potentially be stuck on market for many, many, many months because you overpriced the listing. This kind of intelligence is crucial to smart real estate decision making. But people want to know how many homes are under contract. So we'll do that right now. As of right now, there are a total, and this is residential, detached, and attached. So single family houses, townhomes, condos. When you look at the entirety of Boulder County, on the MLS today, February 21st, there are over 1,000. There are 1,028 properties that are on the market. And then of those 1,028, and Hamish, you can do the calculator, 415 are under contract. Well, maybe I'll do it. 415 over, what did I say that other number? 1,000?
Yeah.
okay. Oh, all right, I'll do it. Hang on. 415 out of 1,028.
How do you have 1,000? What are your parameters?
Oh, okay, hold on. 415, you can hear me typing it, mm-hmm. out of 1,028 is 40%. So 40.4% of the market is in pending or active backup status, meaning it's under contract. So what status am I looking at? I'm looking on IRES and ReColorado through IRES, and it's looking through ReColorado and in theory removing the duplicates. Mm. And I'm just looking at Boulder County as an entirety, and I'm not excluding things like affordable housing. We're looking at all residential housing types, single family, townhomes, condos, apartments, everything that's for sale. I did not choose farm and ranch, but those are really a tiny subset. So roughly 40% of the market. And let me flip to the city of Boulder, because the city of Boulder and Longmont and Louisville, Lafayette are all their own thing and behave quite differently from each other depending on price point and property type. But when you look at the city of Boulder, and you look at the entirety of how many homes are on the market, you get 394. Boy, that seems, 394 entirety. And then of the 394, 129. So 129 over 394, 32.8% of the market is under contract. So historically, that's pretty low. We've had some incredible years since, I want to say 2011, 2012, when it was much more common to see 50, 55, 60% of the entire market under contract. And now we're seeing a lot less than that. But here's the thing. It all depends on property type and location and price range. Like if the moment I were to flip this to detached single family only, for example, and we'll just use the city of Boulder, when you look at single family houses in Boulder, there are currently 233 houses on the market. Oh, yep, that's Mail City, by the way. So that includes places like Gun Barrel. Mm-hmm. And then when you look at just what's under contract, of those 233, there are 70 under contract. So 70 over 233 is 30%. 30% is much closer to approaching what economists for many years have said is a balanced market. A balanced market being about 5 to 6 months of inventory. So 20% is what they really want to see for there to be a balanced market. It's nowhere near what people consider a seller's market, by the way. Sorry, a buyer's market, by the way. This sort of percentage is still firmly in seller market territory, but you're much more likely to find sellers who are ready to capitulate, that have been on the market since January or earlier, that were on the market last year, are not finding offers, are not getting showings. Showings have slowed down. They haven't gotten a reasonable offer. Maybe they got a ridiculous lowball. They ignored it. Now they regret it. And they're much more willing to capitulate and negotiate, especially as we move into March if they've been on the market a few months. So keep that in mind. It's not a fourth quarter play because they still have hope. If their agent's good, they'll tell them that, well, there's more buyers coming into the market and you have another 2 to 3 months of market activity where the seasonal wave is on your side. And you should be checking the competitive landscape every week, and you should be getting feedback from every single showing, and you should not be dealing with only automated emailed feedback because it's garbage. It's super low quality. Your agent should be calling every agent who shows the home, and depending on price point, in some cases also should be attending every showing. So that's the story with market conditions. It's slower than it has been in many years, but not necessarily worse than it was last year. And we'll do year-over-year statistics when we have the full month of February. We'll look at February this year versus February last year. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to paint a generally rosy picture that the market's better this February. But that's me feeling the data for you, not actually analyzing the data. And that's the key difference between us and many other brokerages, is that I really want you to hear the data and then come to the analysis conclusion, not here Osmond's busy with so many showings with his clients and has three listings coming up. Boy, the market's heating up. Mm-hmm. I had a bidding war this weekend. Well, great, you had a bidding war, but how's the actual market?
On an entirely different property, or, you know.
Exactly. I mean, I just saw two this weekend from agents I really like. They're colleagues I respect and admire and I enjoy working with. But they're continually doing this thing where they want you to know that they're in the game. And then they extrapolate their personal experience in one particular transaction, one particular negotiation to represent the entirety of the market. And it's frankly BS.
It doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work for me either. Like, if I tell you we're busy or slow because I'm busy or slow, it doesn't mean... It's sort of like saying, well, you know, the average runners are getting faster and faster because you're getting slower.
Yeah.
At a race.
So when you said there were 1,000, did you mean 1,000 active or did you select like all of them?
No, that's everything was over 1,000. Oh, so it's 400 okay. Something where the under contract. Mm-hmm. I really should do it then do the whole because it's numerator over denominator.
I pulled the stats this morning and I was like, there's only 612 active. And then like my total for 400, and I got 417 under contract total for Boulder County. But that was only 415.
And I'm also doing both attached and detached.
Yep, I am too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder what we're doing differently there.
Because if you didn't just select active, you selected, right, like active...
Yeah, I'm selecting everything. Coming soon, active, active backup, active first right, and pending.
Yeah.
That's the entirety of homes.
I just did coming soon and active. That's where our separate was. I was like, how? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. This is, again, why you want to ask questions when your agent gives you information about how the market's doing. And in particular, if they're sharing generic statistics from Altos Research or from their brokerage, you get a little chart from Compass that says we sold more houses than anybody else. Mm-hmm. That's useless information for you when it comes to making decisions. What you want is actionable information on relative to your specific home that you're selling or the home you're thinking about writing an offer on or the target range and locations that you're thinking about. And the more you have that info, the smarter decision you'll make. You're less likely to overpay. You're less likely to leave money on the table. It's just crucial info.
And so, a lot of these agents too, they're getting their stats from the brokerage. They're not pulling them themselves, and they're not really even giving it a second thought on interpretation. You know, they kind of handed the script of what the market is and just disseminate that on their social media or wherever you get it, without the actual conscious thought behind it.
Or they're scared to do it in real time and they want to go home and do it slowly. Yeah. And I used to do that too my first few years in the business. I'd say, well, okay, let me do some research and I'll come back to you with a list of comps and then we'll schedule a meeting in person. I'll print out these reports and we'll go through it. And the printouts look good and you don't have a lot of buttons to click to ask different questions, right? You're not seeing it in real time. Mm. But since COVID and Zoom and live video calls, your agent has no excuse to not do it in real time.
Yeah.
And if they seem unsure of themselves, it's because they are. Your agent should be able to pull up the comps in less than 15 minutes, walk you through it on a video call. If you want to do that weekly and you're one of our clients, I'm happy to do that with you weekly. It is important to review the competitive landscape if you're going to understand what's happening in the market. And so, for example, let's say your neighbor, you know, plopped a for sale sign in the house. Well, okay, and what if it's priced really low? Well, are you sure it's priced really low? Let's go look at what's going on with this house. And it might be a home that is a buy level that's not quite as attractive. The interior finishes might not be quite as good. It might not have the same bedroom count, or it might be backing to a busy road. They may just simply have grossly underpriced it because their agent told them that was its fair value, and now they need to sell it. And we may just want to sit tight and let that one go. But now you know your home's not going to sell for 2 weeks because all the attention, like little kids on a soccer ball field, like they all play herd ball. All of the attention is going to go on the ball. That's now in the field is this new listing, and you may just have to wait.
And as we've talked about, I think maybe two or three podcasts ago now, we've seen more recently some listing agents intentionally underpricing homes as well to get a bidding war to advertise their skills at getting multiple offers, which is a little insidious.
It's sort of sad, but the more you trust this agent, and the less you ask them to show you, the more tempting it is for them to just go with the low price. So if they ask you, what do you think your home's worth? And you say, well, I think it's worth 1.4, but they think it's worth 1.6 or 1.7. The sketchy agent, the one that is not interested in your doesn't take their fiduciary responsibility seriously is going to say, you know, I think we can probably get to 1.4. What's listed at that? Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, it's like, all right, 1.4, I'm going to be done with this thing in a weekend, and I'm going to collect my commission, my full commission. I'm going to look great. I'm going to get multiple offers. You're going to run around telling everyone you know that you got a bidding war, and Johnny Smith, the agent, is the best. They're so good at marketing. Yeah, John Doe agent. I don't want to name any names, but I know quite a few of these agents that will run with it if you give them a low number. Mm-hmm. I think that it's an interesting strategy to price low, but it should be done consciously and ethically. If you want to price it low to sell it fast, we can do that. But you should have that option compared to price it fairly or price it high. And price it high is actually a really good strategy too for a super high-end listing that you're not in a rush to sell. Because it signals to the market you think it's worth a ton. And as long as you're close to the ballpark or you really understand the value of it, you can then wait. And then you can give the buy side the psychological benefit of having negotiated a really big discount, which mm-hmm. we're going to talk about, by the way, in one of our listings, the listing of the week that we'll get to.
Yeah, I think I think you hit most of that. I'm not sure if there's anything else quite worth mentioning as far as market conditions from two
weeks. We also covered Denver, we cover Breckenridge, we cover Frisco, Louisville, Lafayette, Superior, Broomfield, Colorado Springs. I've done deals all the way into Fort Collins. I usually will not go that far afield unless you have a pre-existing relationship with me as a client, but we have agent partners either in the brokerage or referral partners that we've worked with in the past that we trust that we would refer you to if you don't have a pre-existing relationship with me. But I love to do Breckenridge and Frisco and Winter Park and all of the little mountain towns, as well as, of course, the city of Boulder. It's a city I've lived in for a really long time and know well. So,
yeah.
And also Longmont and Lafayette and Erie, and I just closed the Superior deal. So I'm all over the place, but you want to get the data relative to your specific situation. That's the bottom line.
Well, speaking of knowing Boulder well, a property that you wrote about back in 2016 has just sold.
So this is not a beer. This is an Olipop. It's only 35 calories somehow, and yet it tastes like root beer of my childhood.
Teed up the perfect segue.
You did. And I wanted to crack a beer or crack something for the sound of that home.
Okay.
An Olipop, not a beer. It's a root beer. And you did tee it up. And 755 Jonquil Place is what we're talking about. This is a home that is on the west side of Boulder. So we'll put a link in the show notes where you can click on either Zillow or Realtor.com and actually pull up this house. I'm going to pull it up at the same time. And this property had been listed last August. So August of 2023, which frankly is not a great time to list a home. You're walking into the fourth quarter practically. Mm. You really want to list it in the first or early second quarter to maximize value. But they listed it in August. That's sometimes how life is. And they put a $4.5 million price on this home. It sat on the market for about 2 months, month and a half, and they dropped it $300,000. They dropped the price after 44 days to $4.2 million. And then it sat there until the end of the year, and they yanked it off the market before the holidays. So before Christmas and New Year's, they pulled it off. And they brought it back 2 days later, again, and this time at 3.95. So
500 basically from the original list.
Yeah, basically another $250,000 below the last list price. And now we're looking at 500 and 50 below the original list price. But 1 second, let me just pull up the... there's one question I have, and did the listing agent get fired? because it was only 2 days between the two listings. And usually when it's only 2 days between the two listings, it's not a fired agent. And it does not look like it's a fired agent. They just pulled it. It has new photography between the listings. The photos got better. Same agent. So 2 days later, it was brought back with new pictures, new price, same listing agent. And the broker remarks, of course, are, do not call the seller. There is a listing agreement, which is always funny when they see that.
You've got to protect your agreement.
Yeah, well, I mean, your client should know that. Mm-hmm. And that's not even in the broker remarks. It's in the public remarks, so I don't feel bad reading that. It's in the listing.
It's in comments. The public.
It's in the public in all caps. Do not contact seller.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about this house. I wrote about it in, what did you say, 2017 or 16?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it had been rebuilt. In 2013, this particular spot got nailed in the floods, the September 2013 floods. There is a creek running in the backyard of this home. And let me see if I can get you the name of the creek. It's called the 2 Mile Canyon Creek. And that creek jumped its banks and totally took out the house. And I distinctly remember walking onto Jonquil Place and seeing a river flowing through some of these homes in this cul-de-sac. It just was horrific. And this was one of the homes that I'm pretty sure got completely destroyed, although I don't know that for a fact. I guess we could look up the previous sale, because it did sell in 2016, which is 3 years after the flood. No, that's when it was new. It had been rebuilt. So I don't know if it got completely destroyed. We could look at the permit history if we really wanted to see if a new home permit was declared. But either way, what was there was demoed, because this home is a new permit, was a new permit, because it has a build date of 2014. You know, it's weird. Actually, it doesn't. They changed the build date. If you look at the old listing, it was 2014, and for some reason, it was updated to 2016. All right, now I got to look at the tax record. I don't know if I will pull down the actual building permits. So, if you were our client and you were thinking about writing an offer, this question's kind of important. And the tax assessor says 2014, not 2016. So there's a discrepancy between the listings. It's probably just a typo. But that is one thing that you should always look at is the full permit history of any house. So bottom line, they brought it back 2 days after they withdrew it. Now at 3.95. And it sat at 3.95 through the holidays. And as January neared an end, they got an offer and they negotiated. And it was agreed to. It closed at 3.5. On February 15th, so the day after Valentine's Day last week, this home sold, finally. And it sold for $1 million less than the original list price. And the original list price, had it not been in the flood zone, is probably about right. I mean, I didn't personally review the comps, but this agent's very competent. And it was listed as if it wasn't in the flood. And see, the thing about buying in the 100-year flood or in the flood way, as this one literally is, the backyard is that creek, is that it takes a very particular buyer to be willing to take the risk. And if they rebuilt it in 2014, it should have been built in ways that take the home out of the floodplain. And when you look at the actual flood map, and there's a website for this, we can put the link in the comments, Hamish, but if you pull up the city floodplain map, it brings you right to the edge of the structure. So the home itself is in what appears to be the 500-year flood, the actual structure.
Oh, really?
But that is, you know, inches away from the floodway, like the actual
dedicated
creek, where the water should go. But as we learned in 2013, where the water should go does not mean that's where the water ends up. It's likely to go there, but in 2013, it blew through the banks. And
you've mentioned before, too, floodplains are not an exact science. They're a little bit more politically motivated. So
they're very politically motivated, and they're very conservative, according to our clients who are experts in this. So somebody took a pretty big risk and closed on this. But don't feel bad for the sellers, because compared to what they paid for the property, there's $1 million delta there too. They paid 2.67 in 2017. Let me see if it traded hands again in between that. It didn't. So they have owned it since May of 2017. They paid 2.67 and they sold it for 3.5. So, you know, that's not quite $1 million gain. It's 900 or 850, less commissions. They still did a fine for living in a home for 7 years in one of the most prime locations in Boulder. So west of Broadway, north of Newlands, there's this little pocket of north-south, mostly north-south facing homes. This one happens to be on this little cul-de-sac lollipop that does not have that. But most of them on Juniper and Kalmia are large lots, north-south oriented, and it's very, very private compared to Newlands, which is the neighborhood dead south. Newlands has very nice homes, but most are east-west oriented, and the lot sizes are much smaller. I mean, this lot size is almost 11,000 square feet for a 5,000 square foot house and four bedrooms, five baths, four bedrooms on the upper. The finishes look like they're 2014, but the layout and interior is still a very nice home. So excellent house, except for the floodplain issue. If you were our client, I would tell you not to buy the house at any price because of the floodplain issue, but I didn't represent the buyer or the seller, but that's the tale of 755 Jonquil.
Gorgeous design, personally. I don't think it's offensively contemporary. I think it sits fairly nice in the neighborhood. Looking on street view as well, it looks like they added the fence, which personally I'm not a huge fan of, though I'm sure the front yard, backyard is a lot more private at this point. Pretty home.
Yeah. It's a pretty home. I don't think it's... I like your term. Did you say offensively contemporary?
Yeah. You know, some are just too much. This one, it's nice.
This one's nice, and it's private. There was a house that was on 4th Street that's been on the market for a while. I think it may have finally sold. But that home, every buyer we took to see it got the I'm offended experience.
It's because, too much.
Well, the design was so not private compared to the 4th Street, relative to the 4th Street bike path. It was like living in a fishbowl. Mm. And you would be exposed in multiple rooms of the house by street traffic. And that's not cars. That's literally bicycles and pedestrians walking up and down the street. And, I mean,
that's the price point. The exhibition is there. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You got to... Who knows? Maybe they've got the electronically frosting glass at this point, but...
I suggested that because our buyers were super excited about this house until we did our video for that one. Not Jonquil, but this is the house on 4th Street, and I don't want to throw it too far under the bus, but we did all sorts of performance tests on that house with visibility and sight lines and also the sound in the house because that was a very high concern for that buyer. And in the end of the day, we went a little bit down the rabbit hole into window treatments like films. Mm-hmm. And you, in theory, could do an electrostatic film or something like a Boeing, whatever, the Dreamliner has it, right?
Yeah.
You could opaque the windows with an electric current, but you're going to spend a lot of money replacing all the windows in this house just to block out its essential design feature.
And the view and all the everything else you lose with it. So location, location, location.
Yeah. So Jonquil sold for... huge discount. We didn't do this. Didn't do the math. So 500,000 below, 450 below the last list. So 3.5 over 3.95 minus the one. So 11.4% below list. That's a pretty hefty discount for a spring listing or a late winter first quarter listing.
Yeah.
But it's not really a first quarter listing. It's been on the market since last August. But still, you'd expect it to be more like 3 to 5%. Unless they're reaching desperation stage, and maybe they were reaching desperation stage.
They knew a flood was coming. I kid. We don't know.
Yeah, well, Boulder is one of the most, if not the most, flood risk city in Colorado. Huh. And most people don't realize that.
I was thinking about that today, driving out of it. It is Boulder Valley, you know, so it makes sense. It's a low-lying area.
And there are all these drainages that all come right into the city of Boulder and shoot down Boulder Creek and then shoot to the north and to the east.
Mm-hmm. Well.
Okay. Enough.
I was going to segue it, but you got this.
All right. Let's segue. We are moving on to information in the news in real estate. And as you may know, dear listeners, Boulder has been the, I don't know, orphan stepchild? What's the analogy of infrastructure spending? As a city, we have been seriously underfunded. We have been, some would say, robbed of
not the black sheep.
Light rail. What's that?
Not the black sheep. That's not the...
I don't think that's the right term.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's even politically correct anymore. We're definitely something, but we've been paying for rail. We've been paying for commuter rail between Boulder and Denver. In 2005, when I first moved here full-time, I actually lived here earlier than that, but when I decided Boulder is forever home and moved here in 2005, we had just or were just about to approve Fast Tracks. And Fast Tracks was a huge infrastructure spending bill. Taxes were going to increase and did, and we were promised that we would have light rail by 2014. Well, 2014 came and went, and we got express buses, and I ride those buses all the time to the airport, but they and those buses wouldn't replace Fast Tracks, by the way, because the train doesn't go directly to the airport. The train would go to Union Station first, but still, we never got our train, and it's a thorn in the side. It is of many people. It is upsetting. At the time, I remember there were pundits, because I put out a research report talking about Fast Tracks and its impacts and where the locations of the likely train stations would be and the valuation of real estate there and how it's going to change because of all these studies over how if you're a quarter mile from the station, your real estate could go up 30% overnight when these stations are officially announced. And I got some. I remember this one person's like, "You're such a sucker if you believe we're ever going to get this train." And I was like, "No, believe. And he was right. I was wrong. And now today or this week, there was an article in the Denver Post. Could rail to Boulder finally be built? Colorado has a plan. Boulder and Longmont, the Fast Tracks project has been long delayed and underfunded. And even though we okayed this in 2004, it was never fully built, frustrating residents who just keep paying that tax for a service they never got. And RTD just came out with a new concept plan. They're going to switch the name of the system from commuter to intercity rail, which apparently opens up $102 billion in potential federal funding for freight and intercity rail projects that are not available for commuter trains. So, okay, they're changing the name of the train from commuter to intercity, and that will apparently make it possible for Colorado to tap into this funding. Polis is backing the effort, urging swift action, and the state has gotten $500,000 for identification of routes. I don't know why we needed $500,000 to identify routes, but okay. I guess let's take it. That's government. And supposedly we should be able to run up to 6 trains a day. Wow. Linking Fort Collins, Denver, Colorado Springs, and Pueblo using tracks shared with freight trains. And that's less so at a cost of $2 billion. And that's less than a cost of a fourth of the cost of the estimated system if we built our own tracks and had more frequent trains. So that's the news today, that there's a new plan. And as hopefully you know, Colorado is projected to have a huge increase in people before 2050. And what's interesting is that in this article, and Hamish, you can put a link in the show notes, CDOT's saying they're calculating a population increase of 3 million people before 2050. The demographer's office is, I think, 1.7 million before 2050. But either way, I mean, that's a huge variance, by the way, right? Mm-hmm. The state demographer says 1.7, and CDOT says 3 million. We know it's million plus. Maybe we could say it's 2 million. I don't know what number to throw your hat on. But we are expecting to add a lot more people, but we don't have the housing, and we don't have the transit corridors in Colorado to support that many new people. So the politicians are not just looking at improving transportation, they are looking at all sorts of ways to incentivize higher density in cities. And there's another article that's linked here, Hamish, and this is about it's House Bill 1313 for the year 24. And I don't, you know, this bill is multi-pages long and is probably going to change a bunch of times, but the essence of all of the political movement and pressure. The essence of all of that is they're going to find all sorts of ways to reduce parking requirements, allow duplexes, perhaps even change sacred height limits here in the city of Boulder. And this particular Bill 1313 looks like it's tying transit to that. So that in certain transit corridors, they're going to increase the incentives in the millions of dollars if the cities allow for more flexible housing options. And this is an issue I care a lot about. I care about democracy personally. Let me just say this on a personal note. I care about democracy more than anything else. And if the voters are all for it, then I'm all for it, as long as what's being presented is not deception. And what drives me crazy is how often the bill is named for the opposite of its effect, how political movements and legislation is so deceptive. So I'm very cautious. I also love our small city of Boulder, and there's a lot of people that are frustrated by how hard it is to get around and frustrated by potholes and homelessness, and we can't seem to solve these issues. And the homelessness is not because of a lack of housing. Most of these people are not from our community. So these issues are first and foremost of things I care about personally. But again, I also care about democracy. And if the voters want more density, the voters want more density. And that's what should happen in a democracy. So that's in essence. But people need to be aware of this, because there's certain spots in the city of Boulder, in Denver, in Longmont, in even Louisville, that are in this transit corridor and are very likely going to see zoning changes that enable developers to build a lot more housing.
Mm-hmm.
And that housing historically has been in two flavors in the last 20 years in Boulder. It's been very high-end luxury, or it's been affordable. And the affordable housing, at least in the city of Boulder, is housing you can't even buy. It's only rental housing. And I think that is also a very dangerous approach to fixing the housing problem, because it creates a permanent underclass that never builds equity in their homes.
Right.
And people that are renters, and this is a perception, I don't know if it's true or not, but renters typically are not in a place in their life to settle down. They're still figuring out their jobs and their careers and all these things. That's why they're choosing renting, and they don't have the money or the nest egg, and they're also, that means they're less invested in the community. And I know that that probably angers a bunch of renters. But
well, and unable to invest in it, right?
If they and unable to.
Yeah.
So not having middle-class housing as part of the mix is really bad. And middle-class housing and entry-level housing you can buy. And unfortunately, I think we'll see a lot of just a lot more luxury apartments, which pushes people into it doesn't fix the commuting issue at all.
No.
You get more commuters.
Yeah, that train proposal is very cool, but I'm beginning to wonder if any infrastructure investment in trains, that was interesting noise, if any type of train reinvestment thing is similar to the pursuit of fusion power at this point, you know, where it's like, yeah, it's 10 years away, we'll have trains to Boulder, you know. It'd be cool. Love to see it.
I would love to see it too, and I'm an optimist, and yeah. I really hope that they get the transit part fixed. I like the transit part. I don't like the let's build a lot more density part.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we need to fix transit to the L's in addition to transit to Denver. So the primary the beneficiary for transit on the rail corridor is Longmont, Boulder, Louisville, Arvada, and then Union Station. That's likely the train path. Those communities are going to see a lot of benefit. But what about Louisville? Or sorry, what about Erie? What about everything to the east?
Yeah.
What about Lafayette? We need to have some sort of transit corridor system to move bodies from Lafayette, where there is a lot more affordable housing already,
mm-hmm.
versus build high density in the city of Boulder. And not everyone wants high density. In fact, the American dream is not to live in an apartment. The American dream is largely to have your own private home with a little patch of dirt to grow some, you know, vegetables and throw a football with your family,
yeah.
have a backyard picnic. That's what people want. Single family housing has largely been the American dream, not an apartment,
mm-hmm.
and especially not an apartment you can rent.
Yeah, that's where I guess if it's a permanent rental, it doesn't really help anybody get a leg up. It's kind of difficult. Yeah.
But it does help the city bureaucracy. And that's my suspicion on why this is not an issue that is continually pushed at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because the city bureaucracy, jobs are secure, but people fight for their own interests.
Mm-hmm.
And council approves what is presented or doesn't, calls up. But the city staff controls council agenda, not the other way around.
Right.
And it's really unfortunate, and I sound very conspiratorial, but I just have to say there's a wag the dog effect happening, and we haven't been able to fix it in 50 plus years of trying to fix it.
So yeah, I'm interested in seeing how this bill evolves, because it's by no means finalized, and how it ends up going. I know last year we talked a lot about a bill that was proposed that would increase, was the plan to increase density by 20% in each neighborhood or in each city?
I saw something like that.
Yeah. I think we talked on it as well.
Yeah. I mean, expect more plans, expect more schemes, expect it at the city level, at the county level, not just the city of Boulder, but of course Denver. And all these small towns, too, have incentives mm-hmm. to reconfigure their zoning to underzone, upzone, side zone. I don't know what to call it. I don't think of it as upzoning, by the way. I think that's another disingenuous term that is used to convince people this is an improvement when it isn't for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I think they should call it what it really is, which is a change in zoning to allow for more density, higher density housing, taller housing. And it's a change for more cars on the street and more cars in general, but they're going to under allocate parking, which I'm okay with. Parking, I think, is a horrible use of space, but people generally have cars when they live places.
Especially where cars are kind of a requirement, right? So, I mean, Boulder's got fantastic infrastructure for walking and biking and everything. And then this bill looks to be like they're planning higher density for transit corridors. So, if that fusion train never happens, then maybe that's going to be a better solution. It's kind of a hand-in-hand issue, and you act on one, of course, you're going to be at a deficit in the other until you pick up the pace. And I don't necessarily know if we have the bandwidth to correct both at the same time. So it's a kind of pick your poison thing. Yep. At least how it appears to me.
Yep, I'm with you. And as a resource for those that are scratching their heads and thinking about what Colorado looks like in 5 years, you may want to look at Governor Polis's roadmap to Colorado's future. And I did provide a link in the show notes to that as well. That's where you'll see the data is a little different. You'll see the demographer talking about much lower numbers. But it's important to visualize what's happening. And it's happening in multiple ways, and it's very likely Colorado's future.
I was thinking about that, and I think I live pretty close to Wadsworth. It's a 4-lane highway currently, and it is a highway. It's Highway 121. Everybody calls it Wadsworth and doesn't like it when I call it a highway, but it's a highway. I think that's going to be huge soon, and sure enough, I think a lot of the buildings near it and on the shoulder are going to be the hotels and larger commercial buildings. And I think the spread will go outward from that. So if you're closer to Wadsworth, you're going to be into higher density, more urban environment, because it is a main artery through north-south Colorado, Denver Metro. But yeah, I you can kind of see it happening. You go to older areas like Colfax and stuff, places where there is the main arteries grow first, and then it begins to spread out. So I'm curious too, like the Candelas development over to the west is so far away from any easy commute, but in 40-50 years, is that going to put it at an advantage because it's further from all these extremely developed infrastructure just for all the amount of people that are living here?
Ask the people that live in Queens or mm-hmm. Slightly upstate or New Jersey and have to get into Manhattan, and they have their own restaurants and their own shops, but if their job center is in Manhattan, they have a miserable hour to hour and a half long commute every day.
Yeah.
Each way. It didn't solve it. Their home, that neighborhood may feel less congested when they're there,
mm-hmm.
but when they actually have to get to their job, it's not like that. And a lot of people don't have to drive to work any longer, especially here in Boulder, but that's not true of everyone. And a lot of offices are calling people back. So I think it's going to look a lot like any other. I think the past is indicative of what the future might look like. And that means slower transit. Already in the city of Boulder, I can get around faster on a bicycle than I can in a car. In most cases, most trips under 15 minutes, especially with parking, I can get there faster on a bicycle, on a regular push bike, not even an e-bike. And on the street corridors, an e-bike is way faster.
Mm-hmm.
So bicycles within the city are a very fast solution, but the exurbs or the suburbs like Candelas, Anthem, all these large developments that are out there, I think they're going to have even longer drives in and out as those things get bigger.
Yeah. And you think of, right, like the increased cost of living, people can't live in Boulder, so they're forced to commute, especially if they're working in there, you know, for an entry-level job or for something in industry, then they're now required to commute. So the whole, it just compounds. I really hope these fusion trains happen soon.
I mean, imagine if we had a streetcar that goes right to Lafayette downtown
and
runs every 10 minutes and can take 200 people. And imagine the same thing in Erie and the same thing north of Erie. I'm thinking about the next towns. There's a couple. Decono.
Firestone, right? Imagine Frederick. Yeah.
Frederick, which are fast-growing towns. You know, the stuff out in Weld County where there's lots of cheap housing.
Mm-hmm.
There should be a really fast train that zings in and out and carries 200 people. And, you know, in your world operates on fusion.
no, just that's great. They say 10 years from now, just like fusion. Fusion Power.
Everyone's wearing those goggles, the Apple ProVision, and in their own world anyways. So,
yeah.
Okay, I think we should move on from in the news. So that's the news for this week in the House Einstein podcast. Let's move on to a section we call Tell Me Something I Don't Know.
Yeah.
Well, for many years, many, many years, there was a trend toward much larger homes, the McMansions. And these are 6,000-plus square feet homes, 7,000-plus square feet homes on large lots, typically not in the city center because you can't do that in the city. And that was the American success dream. But anecdotally, and I think we'll start to see this in the data too, there's such a strong demand for small is beautiful homes that accommodate people with mobility issues and also multi-generational desires. They want, you know, a small ADU where their family can stay with them or a caregiver can stay with them, and they want everything on the main level. And this housing type is so challenging because it's almost in non-existence, typically under 4,000 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
And the stuff that is much larger, like the 6,000 plus ones, especially built in the 90s and early 2000s, are really starting to fall out of favor. And I saw that in the early, in the mid-2000s when the market corrected, when there was more than 2 years of inventory of homes in NIWAT, well over 2 years of inventory.
Wow.
And right now at 30%, right, we just did the math for the city of Boulder, 30% of houses under a contract, that implies roughly 3 months of inventory, right? 3 1/3 of a month of inventory. 2 years of inventory is what happened during the downturn between 2006 and 2009 in NIWAT specifically. Because of these homes were so out of favor, there's so much square footage, all of it needs to be updated, all of it needs to be heated and cooled, and the lawn bills out there to water all that grass can be thousands of dollars alone. It's just, and so this is something that you may not know, is that there's a increasing trend towards smaller, more functional homes that appeal to people that have mobility and desire intergenerational living.
Mm-hmm.
They want to be walkable to a coffee shop or a restaurant. And so I think we'll start to see more of these types of homes being converted. So a lot of these Martin Acres ranches, for example, we'll continue to see the bedrooms on the primary turned into a master suite with an office and a second story built maybe as an ADU with a secondary entrance or a basement ADU. That sort of conversion is not going to lose its demand because of this giant wave of boomers who have mobility issues and health issues and also want to be close to their families.
Yeah. Somewhere central, a little bit more connected. The big thing with these huge houses is, I mean, a lot of these McMansions, when do you think they got in favor? Early 2000s?
I think it was like in the 80s.
Okay.
When, you know, like if you think about this, this topic will appeal to you.
Mm.
If you were to put a BMW 3 Series from 1984
mm-hmm.
next to a BMW 3 Series of 2020,
yeah,
it's the 3 Series of 2020 is bigger than the 7 Series
yeah.
of the 1980s.
Leagues, yeah.
Right. So there's a large desire for more comfort and more space, and that was perceived as luxury and has been for a long time. But I think we've reached peak size luxury and are trending the other way, especially as people want to downsize and simplify in their lives.
Yeah. I guess I was thinking like more early 2000s, and the reason I was going that way was it's easy to get into a home, especially like early 2000s when the barriers to financing were a little bit easier. So you get yourself a big home, and then by the time you're ready to sell it, you go ahead, get a decent amount of equity out of it. But anybody else who gets into that house afterwards is dealing with the deferred maintenance that you perhaps didn't do. And you have that much more square footage, that much more space that you have to deal with. HOAs that the house was conceptualized, that you have to water your lawn and you have to maintain your house and keep it painted. At this point, sometimes these houses can become a little bit more of a pit than they can a benefit, you know?
Well, they meet code, but they're also poorly constructed. That's
yeah.
the other thing that I find really disturbing is how poorly built some of these new developments are. They look nice,
mm-hmm.
but the number of mistakes inside the walls are astounding. The level of oversight by regulators is really poor. I would, frankly, much rather have a home built in 1920s and 30s than a home built in the 2020s, other than the energy efficiency factors and some of the design factors like tiny closets. There are problems
mm-hmm.
with these Victorian pre-war era houses, but they can often be solved with an addition that you manage and control, or renovations can fix some of these problems. I've seen some gorgeous examples. They're still small as beautiful,
yeah.
but you don't get this giant 7,000 square foot house with aging finishes.
An ephus
and water leaks and plastic plumbing that now leaches plastic microparticles into your body.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, and you're out there in the middle of nowhere with a giant plot of land around your house that no neighbors can see to. I mean, this is personal preference, by the
yeah,
way.
Yeah, we're being very subjective.
I have bought and sold for our clients any type of house. It's not my business to dictate style and taste. I just have noticed that the construction quality is sometimes really lacking in newer homes. And I think it's because they're just so profit-driven. And same thing,
regulators are incentivized to kind of not look so closely because we do have a housing shortage. So, you know, they don't want to be that link that bottlenecks the whole thing either.
And code improvements are not about quality improvements. They're about energy efficiency improvements.
Mm.
So you get these materials that are just really cheap. Fiberboards instead of hard, you know, actual wood. It's all sorts of cheapening out and lack of craftsmanship too.
So I guess circling back around, if we are thinking about these big houses, these mansions, and they're falling out of favor, do you think they'll correct to a certain level? Is there an opportunity? I think a lot of these layouts, you can't really get a duplex out of them, but what's the correction? How do we go from these big expensive homes that nobody really is interested in anymore?
I think that the investors and the developers are 5 years ahead of you, Hamish, that they're already focusing on tiny houses like Boulder Creek Builders. I've sold a few of those to our clients. They've got a development in Longmont. They have one in Superior, and they're building these 1,200 square foot
pre-existing homes. The ones that are existing, the McMansions that currently have that are falling out of favor, what do you think is going to...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the prices are going to decline.
Okay.
I mean, that supply and demand, those houses are unlikely to be bulldozed. They're likely to just drop in value or skid sideways, just stop appreciating, which is also lost value. And I've seen that year after year. If you go look at these homes in Niwot, for example, and I love Niwot as a community, but you go look at these houses, and they're, for every updated, thoroughly updated, well-crafted house, there's three or four that have finishes from 25 years ago and are really run down, and they're going to cost a ton of money to update because mm-hmm. of their size. So that, you know, that should be factored into the price point.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the sellers usually don't see it. because they've been living in this house for all those years, and they don't see the fact that their home is quite dated at this point. And they want the price point that reflects an updated home. And so there's that struggle between buyers and sellers, and Mr. Market wins. So those homes drop in value. But the investors are seeing this as an opportunity, because they recognize that there's more and more buyers that are cut out of the market, and there's a huge pool of people that can afford a $300,000 or a $350,000 house.
Mm-hmm.
And with these higher density standards,
they
can build a lot more of these houses and still maintain profitability. So I think we're going to see a lot more of these, like wee cottages, they were called. They're not tiny houses.
Mm-hmm.
They are small footprint homes, usually two-story. Sometimes they're townhome style. And yes, they have a one or two-car garage. They're tiny, though.
Yeah.
They're the opposite of the McMansion.
Yeah. And I think that makes sense. You know, excess is excess wherever you take it. It's nice to see, at least anecdotally and in my circles, people moving a little bit away from excess just for the sake of it, and people being a little bit more intentional with the spaces that they use and the things that they buy. And I think that's also being reflected in what's new and hot.
Yeah.
The housing market.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So second, let's move on to the second tell me something maybe you don't know, and that's the impact of AI on the real estate business. And this is just my predictions on it, and I want to hear yours too, Hamish, on where you think this is go, because I know you're really into AI. But the backstory that I'm reflecting on is that when I first created the real estate blog that powered House Einstein in 2005, it wasn't this brokerage, but it was my former brokerage. And then in the new brokerage in 2013, this company is now 11 years old. The blog and written form content, long form content, has always been a central piece of our focus. And the assumption was that the web crawlers, the algorithms, would point people to us. And it turned out, the idea was, if you build it, they will come. And what you're building is very high quality informative content that is hyper local, and they will come and do it regularly. And that has produced a very successful small business, but has not been massive growth for the company. And largely that's because these companies also depend on advertising revenue, right? And so they've got a struggle between balancing who will pay them to drive traffic versus traffic that is driven by high quality content.
Organic.
And with the advent of AI, Google is deeply threatened by search crawlers or algorithms or AI intelligence search platforms that are much, much higher quality, because they made the decision a long time ago that they're going to go with them who pays them. That's why House Einstein, if you were to search Boulder Real Estate on Google, is not on the first page.
Mm-hmm.
And I can assure you, our content is every bit, I mean, that has been such a goal to produce high quality content for so long. It should be on the first page, okay? Mm-hmm. I'm tooting my own horn, but
you put your blood, sweat, and tears into it, yeah.
Over a decade, not into trying to fool people with, you know, fancy banners and fancy, you know, moving web pages and all this other stuff, but with high-quality content.
Mm-hmm.
And this podcast is another piece of that. But building the high-quality content has not driven massive traffic. And AI search platforms are a massive threat to Google's search engine. So they have come up with their own, right? Bard and Gemini. Of course, their investments in their competitors like DeepMind. So now they've got another problem, which is better search engines that point to content that doesn't pay them. So who's going to pay for these platforms? If they switched from providing results based on sponsored results to providing results based on higher quality results, how are they going to manage this particular shift in the landscape?
So it's my understanding that Google has always crawled websites for specific elements so that way it could serve it on their search engine, their results. And then sponsored just took a priority over that. And so in the background, they've always been tweaking their algorithm to try and produce more and more realistic results, more relevant results.
But it was gameable.
Well, yeah.
SEO was gameable.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what AI has done, is it's exploited it. And it hasn't exploited it past the point of sponsored content. Google will still prioritize that. That's why you pay. But what I think we're going to begin to see is algorithms from Google and other search engines, giants essentially, that favors human generated content. And I don't necessarily know how they're going to be able to figure that out, but I think all across the board, with the advent of AI and the more and more artificially generated content we see, human-generated content will start to become premium. It'll start to become priority. The amount of AI content that's already on the internet, it's being flooded, is gumming up the works, so to speak. And there's companies that just farm AI and get ads and exploit the search engine currently. And I think we'll start to just see a big shift towards more human content, because AI is not quite there yet. And when it is, it's going to be very difficult to discern the between the two. But currently, yeah, it's not a great situation.
Well, it's interesting, because not only, like, so it could summarize, for example, this podcast in two paragraphs, mm-hmm. but if it doesn't credit or pay the content creator, isn't it, there's this whole issue of copyright and building intelligence on the back of human workers that were not compensated for their work, mm-hmm. that has yet to be solved. And there are all these lawsuits that are in play right now, too.
Yeah.
You did bring up a very good point, the distinction between sponsored content and search results. Mm-hmm. But the search results pointed to the people that created the search results, right? And now, with what I mean by that is that it went to House Einstein's website, if you click the link in the search results. But now what's happening is it's summarizing the search results from multiple places into a little paragraph or whatever. And maybe it'll be a little video in the future, not even a paragraph. It'll be a very attractive person, right, mm-hmm. who reads you the news. You get to choose your attractive person.
Yeah.
And that person reads you, hey, tell me what's going on in Boulder real estate. And poof, this beautiful person pops up that looks convincing and says, here's what's going on. And it draws on our podcast. It draws on content from hundreds of others of realtors. And it spits out this summary that may not be right.
Yeah.
And and at the end it says, by the way, you should go check out the best compass agent in town who sponsored the results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's okay, so I see what you mean. You're saying if you sponsor something, then the search engine's AI will favor you even though it uses information from all of the sites that it crawled.
I'm saying that Google will pay who pays them. Facebook will drive traffic to who pays them. And that's what they've been doing. I don't think that's going to change, whatever it looks like. And there's this huge question mark over who owns the original content that trained the AI, mm-hmm. and were those people fairly compensated. And I think Getty Images, for example, has shown examples of their
watermark
literally
you
inside this results where you can see Getty Images label there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not quite as blatant when it's stealing
artists'
intelligence from this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Where will it go? It's a fascinating world between advertisers and small businesses and large businesses all trying to get the attention and the business of the consumer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I this is going to probably take a more somber note, but we are, and since I think we've seen the shininess of handheld phone devices being very quick to sign away our privacy rights. And as consequence of that, we are going to see more and more of our content, you and I, Osman, and people around us, being taken and generated into something for a profit. With EULAs, with terms of services, with privacy policies, everything like that, people sign them, they don't quite look at them, and they are really kind of just a cut-all for companies to scrape data and go harder. You know?
Right, so that's sort of a dark view on the world, but I eventually caved for many, many years, Hamish. I didn't pay for any advertising, mm-hmm. zero. I just was philosophically opposed. I said, all I have to do is build better content and we'll get clients. Mm-hmm. And to some extent that worked, but not at the scale I had originally envisioned. And I realized maybe 5-6 years ago that I just have to pay for advertising.
Yeah.
There's no way around it. And
you got to play the game.
So you have to do both. You have to produce really high quality content and you have to pay to drive traffic to do it. And this is something that we've talked about repeatedly on our YouTube videos when we look at some of our competitors that will show you a pretty video, but they aren't paying the platform.
They're not getting it out there.
They're getting like 100 views on this video that cost them $2,000 to produce, and they're not spending the $150 to actually drive eyeballs to it. So the only person that they're paying to do that video for is the seller, who they hope don't notice the view count.
Yep. That's such a strange one to me, too. Because, I mean, like, you can embed your listing video into the listing on iRes. You know, it's that video player tab. But, yeah, I'd push it out everywhere. It's a cool house. You know, it's something you're selling. Even as a real estate agent, if it's a dinky house, still post it. It's your job. It's your career, you know. Have that pride. Disseminate it. Get it out there. But it always just sits on YouTube, yeah.
Yeah, tell the audience why they should buy this house. Share the selling points. Mm-hmm. Tell us the house's story, and convince us that this is an incredible buy for its artistry, for its design, for its location next to schools, whatever it happens to be.
Yeah.
And so few agents are doing that, and if they do it, they don't pay to push traffic, and they just stick it on YouTube. And I really wonder what's going on with these agents, but. That's the opaqueness of the real estate world.
Yeah. Trying to give credit, not even credit, but a second perspective, you know, it's some people don't even realize that you can pay for views on YouTube without it being a sketchy third-party method. And so maybe they've got their video up there and they're just hoping that it's such a compelling house that it'll go viral on its own without being aware of the mechanisms to boost views. But yeah. Now it's something that Google offers. Before, YouTube would ban you if you paid for views. Here we are.
That's right. And yeah. And not paying for views is really dumb.
At this point.
Your job is to sell the house on the listing side.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. So those are tales. Those are the tell me something I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps a little educational for those that are listening inside the real estate business, or if you're just thinking about buying or selling a house. And then the last piece I want to touch on is a little tale from the trenches. And this is something to keep in mind if you do something in a real estate transaction that is off the beaten path. If it's not straight up the fairway or whatever analogy you want, if you do something that's a little unusual, it can come back and bite you if you don't dot the I's and cross the T's. And for example, I had a recent transaction. I won't mention the address or the parties involved, but the seller agreed to pay for some mitigation work for wildfire. And it was all agreed to, and then the lender said, well, I don't want that in the docs. That could be problematic. So we need it out. What's the solution? Well, the simple solution was, all right, well, we can just escrow that, and we'll do it on a handshake, which not how real estate transactions should be done, but we'll make sure. I personally, as a real estate agent, will make sure that this gets done, and our brokerage will pay for it. If for some reason things don't go the way we think they will, you have my personal guarantee, and here's my email. The seller's good for it. Let's just move forward on a handshake. And they agreed. Well, if the excitement of closing, forgot about the escrow, forgot about collecting the money, and now I, you know, got to go chase it, but it's my integrity on the line. 100%, it will get done one way or another, even if I have to pay for it. It's not right I have to pay for it, but I will do so because mm-hmm. it's my integrity on the line. But the take-home lesson is to, one, be really careful you're not committing some sort of loan fraud. Two, to honor your word. And three, to document it.
Yeah.
And four, because it's not a normal system in our real estate deals to have, you know, money that's not part of the transaction. Like, and this can easily happen with something like, I want that artwork.
Mm-hmm.
Or throw in the car, right? I want to see the title of the car signed on the table. Whatever you've done. I mean, real estate, it's so funny. It's like the last stages of the deal always in... more frequently than not, involves some sort of wonky negotiation. I've solved inspection issues with art. The seller said, all right, I agree with you on the inspection issues. You get to choose one piece of art from the house. They were art dealers. And I'm like, I can't believe I'm writing this up, but I'm going to write this up, and we're going to figure out how to do this.
Did you have to write down like the title of the piece and the artist?
And the lender doesn't want to see this in the transaction, okay? Because it's going to gum up their ability to sell it to Fannie or Freddie.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to create a mess and increases the probability of the deal getting kicked back to them, which they don't want. They don't want to own the loan. So it's messy. But any time you negotiate something that's not in the contract, you better make sure you have systems to track and remind yourself. And you also better make sure you're not committing some sort of loan fraud.
Step one, avoid the fraud. Step two, have a system.
Have a system. Yeah. So that's a tale from the trench. It happens to the best agents. I had a deal. This is. I'll share a good story.
I
had a deal.
The best thing you can do is not be defensive and be open to the fact that you might have missed something. In that case, too.
I personally just missed collecting a check from the seller.
Yeah.
The seller is going to cut a check. I'm sure it's annoying to him. But if he didn't cut a check, I would.
Mm-hmm.
If they refused to cut a check, I would. But. It's to also work with trusting parties, people that have integrity and ethics and care about what they do and the community, and that matters to them. And I know that's what the truth with these people. That's the truth with our brokerage. And I'll share a story similar. This is like 10 years ago, a deal with an agent. I'll name him because I've named him before for integrity. There was an issue with the seller had agreed to pay for some oven repairs and then refused to pay it. And the seller, I represented the buy side, the seller... the seller moved left town. They left Boulder and stopped answering all emails and phone calls. And I called their agent, who happened to be Patrick Dolan. And I said, Patrick, we have a $500 bill to fix the appliance, and your seller has stopped responding to the buyer and won't pay the bill they agreed to pay.
Yeah.
And Patrick and I agreed to split it. Even though... You know, it's really neither of our expenses.
Yeah, and you could chase it if you wanted to, you know, if you had the motivation and everything, but...
Let's just get this done. It'll build better friendships between us, and we'll act in integrity and take care of our clients. And if you want to, you can go chase your client for that difference.
But bygones,
my lesson
really.
Is, you have $250 for an expensive lesson.
Mm-hmm.
The lesson is document it at a minimum in an email.
Yeah.
And if nothing else... And it's better to have it in the contract. That's what the real estate commission would say. And
that is what they would say.
Outside the contract.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's what they're going to say. And if you need to write a check to make this go away, write a check to make it go away. If you
just make sure you're good for it. Yeah.
Well,
integrity.
So, tales from the trenches of real estate.
That was a good one. I'm glad you added that in.
When you say, what escrow account?
Yeah.
It's not on the settlement statement. I'm like, well, what the hell month was this that we talked about it? Oh, thank God I wrote it down in an email.
I went and looked in closing docs.
Step by step by step, this is what we're going to do. Because everyone has an email for reference. Everyone's memory is now refreshed. No one's cheating anybody, but they could. And if you had nothing to document it, now where does this leave things?
Get it in writing.
It's better to have it in the contract in writing. Second best is put it in an email, especially if it doesn't have real value and it doesn't really impact the transaction. Like, I'm going to come mow your lawn or shovel your snow away for the next month. Whatever weirdness you negotiated, please put it into something in writing.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, always choose agents and business partners. And also choose your clients when they, you know, filter for integrity.
Yeah. Pretty key.
Well, I think we have chatted, dear listeners, to you for over an hour. And this might be a good opportunity for us to wrap up, and to do so by starting with thanking you for listening this far. If you have feedback, if you have comments, you can send them to me privately. You can also put them on the
comments
on the YouTube. You could email us, send a smoke signal. I really appreciate the feedback. We're trying to entertain you, but also educate you. And hopefully we're successful in that mission. If you are buying or selling, Hamish, what should they do?
Reach out to us personally. Don't make your decisions off of this podcast.
Well, maybe let the podcast influence you. But if you want to find us, you'll find us at HouseEinstein.com. You can also sign up for our newsletter. It comes out about once a month. You can find our Twitter, our Instagram, our Facebook. Occasionally, I post on LinkedIn. We have great agents at House Einstein. They cover everywhere from suburbs of Denver all the way to Fort Collins and into the mountains. And our mission, as always, is to help you make a smarter real estate decision. So thanks again for joining us, and I guess we'll see you next time.
Take care.